Thank you very much. This is a very special group of people. I've been with them from the beginning. Abbey Gate, it's a 4-year anniversary. So we're signing a proclamation honoring them and honoring you and honoring your loved one.
These families deserve answers. We're going to be honest about it. We're going to get to the bottom of it.
And I know from this president, as he's made a commitment, that memory will not be forgotten.
We're so proud of you. We're so proud of your loved ones for giving their life for our country. This is a rectification of a wrong. We correct that wrong today, and we're going to keep on fighting to understand, as Pete said, what happened so it never happens to another family again. But God love you all. God bless you. We're so thrilled to have you here in the People's Oval Office.
On August 26th, 2021, a suicide bombing at Abbey Gate, Hamid Karzai International Airport in Kabul, Afghanistan, claimed the lives of 13 U.S. service members, 11 Marines, one Navy corpsman, and one Army soldier. During the chaotic evacuation of Operation Allied Refuge, here's a brief story on each of these fallen heroes, drawn from accounts of their lives, aspirations, and the impact they left on their families and communities. These stories aim to honor their individuality, sacrifice, based on information from various sources. Marine Lance Corporal David Lee Espinoza, 20. David Lee Espinoza from Rio Bravo, Texas, was a 20-year-old infantry rifleman with the 2nd Battalion 1st Marine Regiment, based in Camp Pendleton, California. Known for his grit and valor, Espinoza joined the Marines after high school with a deep sense of duty to protect his nation. His mother, Elizabeth Holgan, described him as brave enough to go do what he wanted to do to help out people, calling him just perfect. Representative Henry Cellular, Texas, praised Espinoza for embodying American values. Noting his selfless service, Espinoza's courage was evident in his role at the Abbey Gate, where he worked to save others during the evacuation. Marine Sergeant Nicole L.G., 23. Nicole G., from Roseville, California, was a maintenance technician with the 24th Marine Expeditionary Unit, Combat Logistics Battalion 24. At 23, she had recently been notoriously promoted and was photographed days before the bombing escorting Afghan evacuees, including children, to safety. In an Instagram post cradling a child, G wrote, "I love my job." Described as a model Marine, she was a beacon of compassion and strength, a friend shared on social media. She was a Marine's Marine. She cared about people. She loved fiercely. She was my person. Her dedication to help others shone in her final moments. Marine Staff Sergeant Darren T. Taylor Hoover, 31. Taylor Hoover from Salt Lake City, Utah, was a 31-year-old Marine with the 2nd Battalion 1st Marine Regiment, a Marine since graduating high school in 2008. Hoover spent his entire adult life in service. His father called him a true hero who loved serving his country. Known for his infectious smile and respected demeanor, Hoover was adored by those around him. His aunt Brittany Jones Barnett wrote, "The world has lost a true light. Our hearts are broken. Hoover's commitment to his fellow Marines and the mission was unwavering, reflected in his leadership at the Abbey Gate." Army Staff Sergeant Ryan C. Knaus, 23. Ryan Knaus from Corryton, Tennessee, was a 23-year-old Special Operations soldier with the Army's 9th Psychological Operations Battalion, Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Joining the Army after high school in 2016, Knaus loved to laugh, garden with his wife, Alina, and build things with his hands. His stepmother told WBIR-TV that he was a joyful person who brought light to those around him. The 1st Special Forces Command noted, "Our teammate died not only serving our nation, but helping to give others a life of freedom and opportunity." Canals' selflessness defined by his service. Marine Corporal Hunter Lopez, 22. Hunter Lopez from Indio, California, was a 22-year-old Marine with the 2nd Battalion, 1st Marine Regiment, the son of two Riverside County Sheriff's Department members. Lopez planned to follow in their footsteps after deployment. Described as wearing his Marine uniform with love and pride, he saw his service as a calling. His parents' home became a shrine to his memory, with artwork depicting him carrying a child inspired by social media. Lopez's father, Herman, said Hunter understood the despair of those he helped evacuate, finding solace in his heroic acts. Marine Lance Corporal Riley J. McCollum, 20. Riley McCollum from Jackson, Wyoming, was a 20-year-old Marine with the 2nd Battalion, 1st Marine Regiment. Married in February 2021 and expecting his first child, McCollum dreamed of being a Marine since age 2, signing up the day he turned 18. His sister, Royce, said that was his plan his whole life. His wife wrote on Facebook, "I lost my best friend. He would have been the best dad." McCollum's lifelong dedication to service culminated in his efforts to help Afghans escape, leaving a lasting impact on the world. Marine Lance Corporal Dylan R. Marola, 20. Dylan Marola from Rancho Cucamonga, California, was a 20-year-old Marine with the 2nd Battalion, 1st Marine Regiment. Passionate about stage setup and technical theater in Los Alos High School, Marola was known for being there for friends and enjoying family activities like hiking, fishing, and kayaking. His uncle told NBC Los Angeles, "He will be truly missed and always in our hearts." Marola's commitment to his comrades and the evacuation mission reflected his kind and dependable nature, making his loss deeply felt. Marine Lance Corporal Kareem M. Nakau, 20. Kareem Nakau from Norco, California, was a 20-year-old Marine with the 2nd Battalion, 1st Marine Regiment. After graduating from Norco High School in 2019, he joined the Marines, aspiring to make it a career. His father, Steve, told the Daily Beast that Kareem loved the Marine Corps family and had no hesitation for duty. Nakau's devotion to his country and his brothers in arms was evident by his actions at Abbey Gate, where he stood firm to help others in a time of crisis. Marine Sergeant Johnny Rosario Picardo, 25. Johnny Rosario Picardo from Lawrence, Massachusetts, was a 25-year-old Marine with the 5th Marine Expeditionary Brigade, Naval Support Activity Brain. Known for her resilience and leadership, she was among the Marines securing Abbey Gate. Limited personal details are available, but her service alongside her fellow Marines highlighted her courage and commitment to protecting others during the evacuation. Her sacrifice is remembered as part of the collective heroism of Abbey Gate 13. Marine Corporal Humberto A. Sanchez, 22. Humberto Sanchez from Logansport, Indiana, was a 22-year-old Marine with the 2nd Battalion, 1st Marine Regiment. Described as a proud Marine, Sanchez was dedicated to his mission and his comrades. While specific personal stories are less documented, his role in the evacuation effort underscored his bravery and selflessness. His community and fellow Marines honor his memory as a hero who gave his life to save others. Marine Corporal Dagan W. Page, 23. Dagan Page from Omaha, Nebraska, was a 23-year-old Marine with the 2nd Battalion, 1st Marine Regiment, known for his loyalty and determination. He was known as being extremely committed to his duty. Marine Lance Corporal Jared A. Schmitz, 20. Jared Schmitz from St. Charles, Missouri, was a 20-year-old Marine with the 2nd Battalion, 1st Marine Regiment. Passionate about serving his country, Smith was known for his enthusiasm and commitment. Though specific personal details are less available, his actions at Abbey Gate demonstrated his bravery at the face of chaos, helping to secure the evacuation process. His loss is mourned by his family and community as a profound sacrifice. Navy Petty Officer 3rd Class Maxton Doe Soviak, 22. Maxton Soviak from Berlin Heights, Ohio, was a 22-year-old Navy corpsman assigned to the 1st Marine Regiment, 1st Marine Division. Described as a compassionate and dedicated medic, Sovjak was known for his care in both his fellow service members and Afghan civilians. His role at Abbey Gate involved providing medical support under harrowing conditions. His family and community remember him as a hero who embodied the Navy's commitment to service and sacrifice. These are our 13 heroes that we lost 4 years ago today, August 26th in 2021. Serving our nation, wearing our uniform with our flag on its arm. They will never be forgotten. At least not here. They are in our hearts, our prayers, and thanks for their service and sacrifice to our nation and their family's service in granting their time with us to serve our great nation. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio, 103.1 FM, 910, 980 AM, or anywhere on that free Odyssey app. On the fourth anniversary of the tragic loss of our 13, 11 Marines, one Army soldier, and one Navy corpsman, 13 in total on this day during the evacuation of the airport in Afghanistan, I just felt it fitting to tell a little bit of the story about who they were personally, not just their names, their ranks, where they served or who they were, but a little more about them. And, that's what that was about, to honor them a little bit, to show their commitment. A lot of them right out of high school, deciding to serve our country and become United States Marines or serve our nation in the Army or Navy corpsmen who oftentimes serve along Marine units. And tell a little bit about who they were, their stories, the families. Lots of them were in the Oval Office today, and that was the piece we just played at the beginning of the segment. There was obviously the president, the vice president, the secretary of defense, secretary of the VA, all there to greet the families and spend some time with them. And I watched a lot of that coverage this morning live, not just the montage we played. And it was good to see these leaders, secretaries, and the executive branch rally around the families and show them that their sacrifice is not in vain and will still be honored. And I, again, wanted to tell a little bit more about them. So hopefully you feel the same about knowing a little more about the men and women in our uniforms that did make the ultimate sacrifice on that day based on their commitment to serve our nation, to serve our flag, to serve our armed forces. And there's thousands, hundreds of thousands of them right now around the world ready to sacrifice the same if need be. And that's a beautiful honor to remember. So back into some stories here locally today. Scott Township has moved forward with plans for a solar farm in their area. So this has been an ongoing thing in Scott Township. They've declined some. They've approved this one now. Supervisors last week approved a conditional use application for a ground-mounted solar energy facility with about 5,200 panels. A Denver-based developer, Pivot Energy, plan to build a 2.7 megawatt AC facility on 10 acres of property on Carbondale Road near South Abington Township border. The plans call for the panels to be mounted on a single axis tracker, with the project set back 100 feet from the parcel's boundaries around by an 8-foot high fence and trees. The property has been owned by some individuals since 1995. The array would produce about 4,370 megawatts annually, although far more than 300 residents. Gordon Woodcock, Pivot's project director, said in the application, it would be accessed by a 20-foot gravel driveway. So that 4,300, just over 4,300 or just under 4,400 megawatts annually is enough to run 300 average residences. The site wouldn't emit light, noise, or odors, pollution, and other emissions, and would comply with township ordinances and operations. fire and explosion hazards, noise, lighting, and glare was in the application. It would include native plants, have stormwater management and a decommissioning plan in place. And interconnection approval with PPL. The township's planning commission approved the project in May with conditions that there be glare control during construction and decommissioning bond with the township. Decommissioning bond, for people who don't know what that is when this is all said and done, if the company goes out of business or for whatever reason, this needs to be taken down and dismantled. There is a bond in place that's held to give township the ability to do that work if the company is no longer viable or around. You know, this has happened time and time again. As a matter of fact, I was digging into that Canadian electric bus company that went bankrupt, and you have multiple school districts from around the nation that are waiting for buses that may never come. Some buses that were delivered on a limited basis have already broken down from this company, but yet there's no company to repair them or do anything with them. So that entire debacle that was billions of dollars of taxpayer dollars that went to a Canadian company to supply U.S. school districts with up to 300 electric buses really has gone bust, to say the for lack of a better term. And so here, this decommissioning bond is if this solar company goes broke or disappears or goes bankrupt or for whatever reason, the township has access to funds to decommission, remove, clear, get rid of the solar panels and the infrastructure that's there and decommission the solar farm. So that's a good thing. We should demand more of that for more projects, considering the way these tax dollars are thrown at companies that end up spending them and then disappearing, and then the taxpayers left to clean up the mess. It was interesting because I was looking at these electric bus school buses. If anyone in the Scranton School District has an idea, we were supposed to get a bunch of them, and I believe two were delivered. Did we ever get the other 25 buses that were supposed to be delivered, the electric buses, to Scranton? I have no idea. I just was looking into it when I was looking at this Canadian bus factory, because there are school districts as close as Ohio that have been screwed by this company going out of business that are awaiting school buses that they don't think will ever come. And they depended on those school districts. They based contracts on these electric buses. And Ohio was one of probably about a dozen school districts around the country, which got me thinking about the Scranton School District electric bus, because they did purchase them. They did change the busing contract with an entity to able to apply for grants for electric buses. All I could find online was that two were delivered. Now, more might be delivered. Again, that's all I could find online. So if anyone has any update, you can text the station, 570-883-0098, and let me know, have we gotten all the buses, the electric buses in Scranton, and have they been operational? Are they ready to go for this school year? Let us know, because it appears that there's a lot of school districts around the nation that are in limbo because of this Canadian bus factory that promised 300 electric buses that went bankrupt after receiving millions of dollars, if not billions, from the Biden administration. And the limited buses that they did deliver have already broken down within a few months of use. And the school districts don't know what to do with them because they can't get them repaired. It's 3:31 here at WILK. It's time for the news with Paul Michaels. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio. If you missed the honoring of the 13 Marines, soldier, and sailor in our opening segment, it is up on our Facebook page now, so you could check it out there and hear it again, share it with your friends and family. Well, a 10-year-old boy was robbed of a bike in Wilkes-Barre. Yeah, 10-year-old boy was assaulted, robbed of his bicycle by another juvenile near the Wilkes-Barre Park Friday evening. Unidentified boy, which he should be, he's 10 years old, had been near Minor Park along Old River Road around 5:15 p.m. not dark out yet, when he was approached by another boy estimated between 13 and 15. The teen asked the younger boy how much his bike was worth and then punched him in the face, police said. The teen then stole the bike and fled the scene, according to police. A 10-year-old boy, the victim, riding his bike in his neighborhood, approached by a 13 to 15-year-old. I mean, there's just so much wrong here. There is so much that could have been avoided to get to here. I mean, how does a 13 and 15-year-old, alone, by himself, as per reports. So, hey, I'm not with a group of friends. It's not peer pressure. There's not, protection in numbers. Just a 13 and 15-year-old boy sees a younger victim, says, hey, I could do what I want here. And I'm just, not only am I going to take the bike, but I'm going to inquire about it, then take it. So there was thought process here. And it doesn't say the outcome of this. If anybody knows if this bike has been recovered, if they have identified this 13 or 15-year-old. And again, because of juvenile, I'm not expecting names or anything like that, nor do I want them. But hopefully this kid is caught. Hopefully this kid is disciplined. Unfortunately, our juvenile justice system has been known for coddling and cultivating criminals rather than actually punishing them, which is why I'm a firm believer of revamping that system more of a boot camp style. Not hard labor, but pretty much there. Something that really tests your abilities physically and mentally as a young person, as a juvenile, to teach you respect, teamwork, what hard work actually is. And a little taste of, if you're going to go down a path of crime, a life of crime, this is what your future is going to look like. And it's not going to be any prettier than this. This is probably the easiest it's going to be in this juvenile facility. I like the drill instructor type, tough love is probably a bad word for it, but what I'm talking about, that boot camp style mentality. It works to strip down people who want to join the military, people who go to police academies and fire academies. It strips them down of their individuality and builds them up in a team environment, builds them up to be more confident, to be more secure, to not have to depend on looking for smaller victims to steal a bicycle. But here's someone that was by himself, decided, I'm just going to take what I want. And for a 13 or 15-year-old to have that mindset, that's scary. That's dangerous. Because you put a weapon in someone like that's hands, which, listen, the average age of armed carjacking in D.C. before the past 2 weeks was between 13 and 15, armed. So, here's someone, a 13 to 15-year-old, that walked up to this 10-year-old boy, asked him how much his bike was worth, punched him in the face, and just took it, and felt it was okay, and he was safe to do that in his environment. I really don't know the area around Minor Park along Old River Road, but 5:15, it's not dark out yet. It is light. If this something like that was attempted back in my day when I was 10, 13, or 15, and I grew up in New York City, and these things were not, I had my bicycle stolen when I was about 10 by a group of individuals, two older brothers, cousins, friends that were in their upper teens, and probably by two that were a little older than me, 12 or 13, in my own backyard. Our backyard were actually common backyards because they were townhouses. So they obviously had numbers and peer pressure. Were they initiating into something? Could have been. I remember the older ones drive by on their bicycles and asking, are they going to do this? Because they were talking too much. And then they, after that encouragement from their older siblings, cousins, friends, whatever they were, they went about trying to take the bike. Now, their method was pretty much just to try and hold me, one of them, while the other one pulled the bike away from me. But something I obviously remember to this day, and I'm sure this 10-year-old will remember when he's in his 50s and 60s. So hopefully, the thing was, though, that neighbors from all around, when they heard the ruckus, some of them jumped out of windows. Some of them jumped in their cars and started doing searches for the people. And they ended up dumping the bicycle and taking off, and we ended up getting it back. But interesting that there was no one around to help this young 10-year-old. And sad that this 10-year-old boy had to go home without his bicycle after, you know, a traumatic event like that. But just here in our backyard, 10-year-old boy assaulted and robbed of his bicycle by a 13 or 10-year-old, a 15-year-old. Just sad. It's 3:42 here at WIL. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio. Somebody asked if the 10-year-old boy was by himself. It appears so. Didn't say anything. And no, they did not give any more information about the demographics to the victim or the suspect in this story. So, Luzerne County Board of Elections, Bureau of Elections, is looking at options to put campaign finance reports back online while protecting the release of candidates' personal identifying information on the documents. The Bureau in June removed copies of campaign finance reports from its website in response to privacy and security concerns raised. The reports are still available for public inspection at the election office in the county's Penn Place building in Wilkes-Barre, and the Bureau can provide campaign finance reports with an email after receiving a request using a form posted on the website. During last Wednesday's election board meeting, election director Emily Cook said that the Bureau has had discussions with two potential vendors and is in the process of determining which of those would be best option to reinstate those reports being publicly available while still providing the protection to the candidates and committees. This information should be online. I mean, it's public anyway. You can get it anyway. So it should be available online. And I don't think it's difficult to redact personal identifying information that should be confidential. But other than that, it should be out there. And it's interesting how they have to go to old where you set out a fill out request forms or freedom of information requests, but other things, you know, are allowed online. But, you know, they want to make it hard for certain things. This shouldn't be one of the things that are hard to find. Matter of fact, I think these things should be more transparent, not less. So it's good. Hopefully they follow through with it. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio. You can call or text at 570-883-0098. Let me go to the phone now. We have Mike from Bloomberg's. Mike.
So I'm watching Bloomberg TV, and the mayor, or not the mayor, but the governor of Connecticut is essentially blaming the high electricity cost in Connecticut on Donald Trump and wants him to do something. So lately I've been dabbling in this AI thing, and I like Claude a lot, and I use it a lot. And I asked Claude, what are the contributing factors to the high electricity and energy prices in Connecticut? And he gives me a list: government mandates and regulatory cost, electrical power subsidies, environmental regulations, and then here's the big one: natural gas supply constraints. Okay, so, you know, we can't really ship our gas here from Pennsylvania up to Connecticut because New York shut down the building of the pipeline that would have got it there. And then this is the one that really got me: pandemic related cost. Basically, they refused to do any disconnections during the pandemic, and it was in May, the middle of May, before they started penalizing people for not paying their bill. So to me, we have a Democrat governor of Connecticut going on national TV telling the public that Trump needs to lower their electricity prices, when in fact the AI comes up with all these reasons. And I had to then prompt the AI saying that Trump is refusing to fund an offshore wind project. And basically, that's how this guy is blaming Trump. It's the offshore wind project that will not be able to give Connecticut all the electricity that they need.
Yeah, it's funny. I was watching about that offshore wind project, and it's all in New England, not just Connecticut, but Connecticut is part of that, where Trump has ceased the construction of the wind farms that are were in the process out there, taking, you know, stopping billions of dollars. But it's interesting because the company and people like the governor of Connecticut and such like that are blaming Donald Trump. But the company themselves stopped their own projects off in New Jersey and lower wind farms that they had in development for viability reasons. They said it wasn't economically viable, so they stopped them themselves. But because Trump did it in the New England sector, they're using that as a blame game to say, hey, well, it's not us. It's the administration that's doing this to us. After they already stopped their own program, saying they just weren't viable off the Jersey Shore.
You know, Rob, I watch a lot of TV and listen to the news kind of like you do. And basically, when you're looking at the mainstream media, America would be nirvana right now if it wasn't for Donald Trump. That's the case that they're making. Everything would be perfect because all the problems are caused by Donald Trump, evidently.
It is. And I guess we're all in detriment because of it. Which platform is Claude? I've never heard of that AI platform.
You know, I don't know. I have I'm 70, and one of my friends was still working at age 70 as an editor for Truist Bank. And I asked him, do you use Claude? And he said, yeah, for a lot of my editing work. And I asked him what he used, because he's the one that always taught me about computer stuff. And he said Claude. So I just went on it, and I don't know who runs it or anything like that. Maybe I'm naive and trusting it, but I think it's fantastic in what it can do, and I'm really amazed at how quickly it can answer a question. Like, I can give it a 1,500-word article and say, could you summarize this in 200 words? And in the blink of an eye, it's right there before my eyes.
Yeah, Claude is the AI platform. Claude is run by the AI research company Anthropic. So Anthropic is a company that runs that platform, Claude. I've never heard of it before. You know, I've heard of a bunch of them. You know, Google has their own, X has their own. You know, there's ChatGPT. There's a bunch of them out there, but I've never heard that one. I got to check that out.
It's interesting. Like, I ask him, if I send you a picture, can you tell me about it? And from what I remember, he said he doesn't have that capability right now, but they're working on it. You know, so it's very interesting, and I really enjoy it. And my wife once said to me, she said, do I have to worry about you having another mate here or what? You know, she's bugging me about how much I use it, but I do enjoy it, and you might find it interesting yourself.
Yeah, actually, some of the founders from Anthropic were employees of OpenAI, which is ChatGPT, and they left OpenAI partly due to disagreements over the company's direction regarding AI safety, and they started Anthropic and this Claude AI platform. So, you know, they all stem from the same place, but it looks like they had a different idea where it goes, and they wanted to be more safe. So it appears you're in the right direction, and if it's doing you right. It's interesting the things that it comes up with, though. And you know what it is? They know that the average U.S. citizen, the average person in Northeast Pennsylvania, won't go to that event. They'll listen to the governor, and they'll say, oh, we see, we told you. This guy in the White House is crazy. Look what he's doing to Connecticut. It's just all his fault. Instead of doing a little bit of research to say, no, like crime in D.C., you know, that's Donald Trump's fault. He's literally saving lives. And I understand, you know, you don't want the National Guard. If you allowed your police to do the job they were hired to do, you wouldn't need the National Guard. You know, there's police departments around the nation that are doing a great job because they're allowed to do their job. In D.C., he's not one of them. So it's amazing, you know, how he's turned these things around. And I got some numbers I'm going to play in a second. Just to show just that.
You know, you mentioned D.C. I have a nephew who has a job down there who we don't really know what he does. But he said many of his friends don't have a car because of the risk of, you know, living where they live in carjackings. So they, you know, it is expensive to have a car down there. But they said one of the main reasons is the number of carjackings, people just stealing cars.
That indeed. I know people who live down there who have seen a night and day difference over the past 2 weeks. Mike, I appreciate your call today.
You take care now. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Yeah, that Claude AI. And I've never heard of it before. So Anthropic, the company. I'm going to look into that. Check it out. Now it says, when you look at it, it says neither Claude nor ChatGPT is definitively better overall. It's all dependent on your specific task. Claude excelling in handling large documents, creative writing, and complex coding, while ChatGPT is stronger for multimedia, quick tasks, personal assistance, and diverse feature sets. So Claude's superior context window makes it ideal for amazing, extensive text, whereas ChatGPT integrates a feature like image generation and video creation. Sora offers a broader multimedia experience. So it all depends on what you're using it for. But it's always great to learn something, and we just did, about Claude AI. It's coming up on 4 o'clock here on WILK News Radio. We'll be back.